The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I think it is a commentary about the boundaries of defamation law, but it's also a much bigger commentary about the way that disinformation is incentivized and rewarded and amplified in our sort of current modern media landscape.
I'm Quinta Dresick, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 16th, 2022. Today, we're bringing you another episode of our Arbiters of Truth series on the online information ecosystem. And we're talking about efforts to use a perhaps unexpected tool to counter misinformation and disinformation, defamation law. If you loaded up the internet or turned on the television somewhere in the United States over the last 2 months, it's been impossible to avoid news coverage of the defamation trial of actors Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, both of whom sued each other over a dispute relating to allegations by Heard of domestic abuse committed by Depp. In early June, a Virginia jury found that both had defamed the other. The litigation has received a great deal of coverage for what it may say about the fate of the Me Too movement, but the flood of falsehoods online around the trial also raises questions about how useful defamation law can really be in countering lies. Evelyn Dueck and I spoke with Ronell Anderson-Jones, the Lee E. Teitelbaum Professor of Law at the University of Utah College of Law, and an expert on the First Amendment and the interaction between the press and the courts. Along with Larissa Lidsky, she's written about defamation law, disinformation, and the Depp Heard litigation. We talked about why some commentators think that defamation could be a useful route to counter falsehoods, why Ronell thinks the celebrity litigation undercuts that argument, and the few cases in which claims of libel or slander really could have an impact in limiting the spread of lies. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 16th. Defamation, disinformation, and the Depp Heard trial.
So there's been a lot of conversation about the Depp Heard trial lately, and a lot of that is gossip and rumors and flat-out falsehoods. So I think it would be really helpful to start with a really basic overview, 101, of the legal issues here and talk about sort of the posture of this. So who was on trial for what and what did they have to prove?
Yeah, so the case was initially a defamation suit brought by Johnny Depp against his ex-wife, Amber Heard. A defamation suit arising out of statements that she made in an op-ed that was published in the Washington Post. And in this Post opinion piece, she made reference to herself as a figurehead, a person, a public figure who had become a face of domestic abuse. And he, although not named, claimed that this harmed his reputation, this was defamatory against him, and brought a libel suit against her. She subsequently countersued for defamation arising out of a series of statements that were made by Depp and by folks who worked for Depp, suggesting that she was a hoax artist. And she said that that was false and defamatory about her. So in both of these instances, we had public figures who were suing for defamation, who had to meet a very high bar. The U.S. constitutional standard here says that they had to show not only that what was said about them was false and that it harmed their reputations, but also that what was said with knowing falsity or reckless disregard for the truth. Not that it was just sort of sloppy or inadvertent or negligent, essentially that it was a purposeful lie. So we had suit and countersuit both rising and falling on these suggestions about the about what went down in their now dissolved marriage. And so a lot of the evidence that played out at the trial was evidence about abuse, physical, emotional, sexual abuse, and the direction of that abuse, who abused whom.
I think that regular Lawfare podcast listeners might be a little surprised that we're covering this. I think it's fair to say that we're not the the go-to podcast for celebrity gossip. You know, we tend to talk about technical issues, nerdy legal questions. Can you explain for someone who hasn't been following this story at all and doesn't really know the main players, why does this story matter? Why should we care about it?
Well, it matters a lot because defamation law has come front and center in a wider conversation about First Amendment doctrine in this country. And it comes on the heels. So firstly, I think we should note, it's a surprising result. Libel cases don't go to trial with any frequency. They settle out of trial, in part because most people who are bringing defamation suits prefer not to have all of the details of a lie that was told about them played out in public again at a trial level. This suit was obviously motivated by differing concerns. And it is also the case that libel suits that have to meet this very strict actual malice standard particularly do not go to trial because they are widely viewed as largely unwinnable. The bar is so high, it's so difficult for public figures to prevail that they're often advised not to go to trial, bring these things before a jury. So it's important in the sense that it represents something that doesn't happen very often. It doesn't happen very often that we have public figure libel suits that go to trial, and it definitely doesn't happen very often that we have public figure libel suits that are won at trial. But this is all also situating itself within a wider conversation that folks are thinking about in terms of the First Amendment jurisprudence. In dissenting from denial of certiorari in a case last year, a couple of justices of the Supreme Court, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas, suggested that the court should take a case to reconsider New York Times versus Sullivan, the foundational First Amendment precedent in defamation law. And interestingly, one major premise of both of their critiques of Sullivan is that the changing social media dynamics and the accompanying disinformation crisis that are happening in our society mean that democracy preservation may now actually require rethinking Sullivan in order to serve those anti-disinformation goals. So this case is a really interesting one for the way that it situates itself at that that intersection between disinformation and defamation, and for the insights that it gives us about the interrelationship between them.
Yeah, so we definitely want to come back to New York Times v. Sullivan. It is, after all, why we got you, the First Amendment expert, onto the podcast to talk about it, because there's so many issues raised here. But before we get into the really nitty-gritty of the sort of legal landscape, let's sort of close out or talk about how this case in particular played out. So I think the verdicts were a little tangled difficult to follow if you weren't following it really closely. What did the jury find? And you mentioned that you were a little bit surprised at the outcome. So what surprised you about it?
It's surprising in a couple of ways. I mean, firstly, it's surprising because we have public figures winning. The jury found for Depp on multiple claims, in essence, that Amber Heard, his ex-wife, had told deliberate lies that were damaging to his reputation in that op-ed, and awarded what they would have given him $15 million, $10 million in compensatory and $5 million in punitive, although Virginia has a cap, and so that was instantly reduced by the judge. But interestingly, they also found for Heard on one of her claims, one assertion that she made that she was subjected to a knowingly false reputation-harming lie and awarded her $2 million. And in some respects, folks who are sort of watching it closely think that those are a little bit contradictory, right? That they were each suggesting that the other was abusive in their relationship and that the jury would find that both of them had lied either individually or through their agents. But that's the result of it. And because Depp prevailed on all of the claims that he brought. And because he walked away with significantly more money, Depp fans in the aftermath were sort of gleeful. Those who saw it as a sort of spotlight on the question of the Me Too movement and the sort of centerpiece that Heard and her counsel had, the ways that they had highlighted this, were sort of deeply concerned about that result. But in the end, what we have is two defamation claims, both won at least in part, and both won by public figures.
So I think before we sort of unpack everything that you've set out, I do want to give a picture for maybe listeners who haven't been following, like, just what the information environment around this trial was like over the 6 weeks that it took place. So from my perspective, at least, as someone who sort of wasn't following it closely, I couldn't get away from it. News about it was absolutely everywhere. You know, even if I tried to avoid it, every website that I loaded, I would get served suggested content. You know, it was in the top five stories on the New York Times, the Washington Post. I happened to be on YouTube yesterday, and one of the top recommended videos was like three great comebacks from Johnny Depp during the trial. There's also been a huge amount of reporting about how on TikTok in particular, fans of Depp, since you mentioned the sort of fan culture around this, just posted an unbelievable amount of content mocking Heard and lionizing Depp and sort of making memes out of the trial. So you've written in this piece in Slate, you describe a tsunami of distortions and disinformation. What did that look like from your perspective? I would ask if it's typical for a defamation trial. My sense is no.
Yeah, well, I mean, the typical is that there aren't defamation suits of this sort that move to this stage, but it's also not typical even for those that do. And in part, this is this is something of a unicorn, right? People moving forward on something that other folks would not want to make public, in a way that sort of leads us to conclude only that they very much, that Depp in particular in bringing the suit, very much wanted to make this public and to use it for its publicity purposes, as much as, or very much about the court of public opinion, as much as it is about the court of law. And so a part of what we see in The Perfect Storm here is this sort of star-studded lineup of witnesses, a series of quite salacious stories about, you know, vengeful defecation in the marital bed and a message written in severed finger blood and cigarettes extinguished on human faces. Right? It's a case that has testimony that features these kind of really like prurient glimpses into the extent to which, you know, rich people own and heedlessly destroy their property and sort of, you know, lurid tells of drug abuse and physical and verbal and sexual assault. And from there, it's a very short step to these incredibly unfounded conspiracy theories on sites like YouTube and TikTok and viral but deeply misleading clips and memes. There was Court TV coverage that had cameras from all different angles, right? So you could get everyone's expression about everything at all times. And what this leads to is this disinformation environment that was sort of fan-base driven, but also potentially taken advantage of by other folks with other agendas. So, you know, Heard blows her nose it turns into a meme that she's snorting cocaine on the stand, or a person who bears passing resemblance to Heard's lawyer appears in a picture from one of Johnny Depp's premieres, and it becomes this whole secondary story about how she had secretly taken the case out of love for Depp and wanted to tank the case. You know, Depp doodles and it's deemed adorable with cartoon hearts. He adjusts a phone cord for his lawyer, and it's seen as this sort of romantic, chivalrous gesture. There are people reenacting testimony in sort of mocking ways, or reading text exchanges with, you know, reverence or sometimes lust. And so it becomes this very caricatured situation really quickly, right? Grins and smirks and body language analysts and trial-themed dance-offs. And some people are in it just sort of for the clicks or likes or the branding opportunities, right? So there are loads and loads of people who are quite obviously just trafficking off of it. Lots of people who used to have content of some other sort shifted over to this content because they saw how valuable it was and how viral it would be. So we had lots and lots of sort of influencers turned court commentators that were happening here. But we also saw folks taking advantage of it for other sorts of reasons. So men's rights activists and right-wing media figures, attackers of mainstream media who are working hard to build fan bases and to take advantage of it to lay a foundation for other reasons. So it really did become this kind of font of disinformation in a really complex and widespread way.
Yeah, I think that paints a really helpful picture of just how extreme and, you know, frankly, distressing the information environment has been over the past few weeks around this. But let's go back to the legal issues that we teased around New York Times v. Sullivan. So you write in your Slate piece that the trial came at a moment of contentious debate about defamation law, specifically debate about whether the First Amendment gives too much protection to defamatory speech. And, you know, New York Times v. Sullivan is perhaps one of the most famous cases in American law. And if people don't know the details, they may well have heard of the words actual malice and, you know, understand that they mean something really important about the First Amendment. You know, it is one of the iconic cases in, you know, being representative of the exceptionalism of the First Amendment, I think it's fair to say. So can you describe what the status quo is before we get to how it might change? What is the rule from Sullivan? And what does it mean as a practical matter for defamation actions here?
Yeah, the Sullivan rule, I mean, I think you're right. New York Times versus Sullivan is sort of the Brown versus Board of Education of First Amendment law, right? A foundational principle set forth in which the court essentially constitutionalized American speech tort. It constitutionalized the law of defamation. And it said, we have a set of concerns about the ability of particularly powerful people, public officials and public figures, to weaponize defamation law in a way that shuts down speech on matters of public concern. And the fact pattern in New York Times versus Sullivan really sort of gives us a sense of why they thought that would happen. It was happening in the sort of throes of this difficult and often violent struggle for civil rights in the American South. You know, activists were engaged in this civil disobedience, and the story of their movement was carried through the nation through this kind of handful of prestigious northern newspapers, especially the New York Times. And the Times carried this full page editorial advertisement and found itself subjected to a series of, but particularly this particular defamation suit over some very minor inaccuracies, and subjected to staggering, at the time, you know, $500,000 jury verdict was enough to really paralyze the news operations of an organization. And in fact, the New York Times did pull coverage from Alabama for the better part of a year as a result of a series of these defamation actions that were quite clearly aimed to do just that, to shut it up. And so the Supreme Court held unanimously in Sullivan that in these sorts of instances where we have a public figure, a public official, was the Sullivan standard, a public official who wants to bring a libel suit for this conversation about their work as a public official, has to meet this actual malice standard. So in addition to proving the falsity, the burden is on them to prove the falsity by clear and convincing evidence, and the burden is on them to prove so-called actual malice. Actual malice is a terrible phrase for what is really going on here, because it doesn't mean either malice in the way that we think about it or actuality in the way that we think about it, but it is essentially a very high standard of fault that the speaker of the defamatory words wasn't just negligent, but rather spoke with knowing falsity or with reckless disregard for the truth, a sort of high degree of awareness of the probable falsity. And absent that, the court said, a defamation is not a tool that you can use. We want there to be a sort of vibrant exchange of ideas, and we want to make sure that conversations on matters of public concern can flourish. And false statements are sort of inevitable in free debate, the court said. And so commentators in that space need there to be, you know, breathing space. Provable truth is just sort of too great an onus to put on people who are criticizing the government or the powerful, because it will cause them to self-censor rather than conveying like the important gist on a matter of public concern. And as a First Amendment matter, we now have that folded into the defamation standard and required of all people who are public figures or public officials bringing those suits.
We want to make sure we go back to this question of sort of where Sullivan stands now and whether its position might be shaky. But before we do that, I want to talk about what defamation looks like in terms of its relationship with disinformation under existing law. So you write in Slate that there is this growing idea that defamation litigation could be used to tamp down disinformation. How is it that proponents of this idea argue that it would work, given that, as you just said, there is a really high standard when a public figure is involved?
Yeah, it's a little unclear how they think it would work. Justice Gorsuch, in fairness, Justice Gorsuch, the most that we've gotten out of Justice Gorsuch about this is this sort of vague hand-waving dissent from denial of certiorari in a case where he said, I would urge us to take a case that reconsiders Sullivan. And he says, the reason, among the primary reasons that I would do so, is that I think there are some grave risks that are posed by rampant social media disinformation, right? Our political and social stability are at risk. And to be clear, I agree with him on that starting premise. I think that those concerns are well-founded. There is something of a sort of disconnect between the concerns that Gorsuch articulates and the doctrinal revisions that he considers. But in essence, I think the sort of baseline principle is that he thinks that we have this sort of new media environment that the sort of evidence suggests to us is facilitative of a spread of disinformation, and that widespread disinformation means that we need to crack down on lies, right? At base, we need to crack down on lies and have more tools for combating lies. And because, in his view, defamation is one such tool, it would make sense for us to unwind some of the protection that Sullivan gives to lies. And as a result of that, the suggestion is that disinformation would be diminished.
And so I think we've kind of gotten to this, but what is it about the Depp-Heard trial that you think undercuts that argument?
Yeah, I mean, I guess lots of things. I think the argument is undercut in a series of ways. I mean, as an important starting matter, this doesn't really represent anything close to the full scope of disinformation that is at the core of the concerns. I think the core of the concerns for Gorsuch, right? Much of the most problematic disinformation that's at the core of our disinformation crisis just isn't itself defamation. Huge swaths of the rampant lies that have caused the gravest concern, you know, as to elections, public health, or otherwise, they're not attacks on the reputation of any individual or entity. I mean, they lie, to be sure, but they don't defame, right? I mean, occasionally the two do overlap. You know, if we have a lie about a particular postmaster backdating mail-in ballots or a particular election official violating the law or a particular, you know, voting machine company committing fraud, then defamation litigation might be a useful pro-democratic tool in the ways that Gorsuch apparently envisions, but there's no reason to believe that disinformation as a wider phenomenon is going to serve itself up in a way that merits a defamation claim. And indeed, we know as a matter of some significant research in this area that very often doesn't, right? That a lot of social media disinformation is generated by a very small number of initial producers for money or political gain and then disseminated broadly on platforms by these armies of others who make broad claims that are false, but not harmful to any individual reputation. So as a starting matter, the fact that we so rarely get disinformation served to us in the form of defamation, I think, is a big principle. I think, additionally, as a very practical matter, the sort of Depp-Heard trial shows us that the reason that we got this sort of unicorn of a situation is that there were two very rich people involved. The online social media mobs that are out there disseminating lies are not actually natural targets for defamation suits because they're often anonymous, and they're also not attractive targets for these suits because they lack the assets to pay damages. And of course, the social media platforms themselves are statutorily immune from these actions under Section 230. So there's really sort of no serious disinformation scholar who thinks the best, most efficient primary way to address disinformation as a crisis is through these kind of series of time-consuming, expensive libel litigations against the really kind of shallow pockets of individual social media users that Justice Gorsuch sees polluting the public discourse. But the Depp-Heard situation adds to this a really interesting dynamic, which is that it turns out that disinformation can be compounded and advanced by defamation suits rather than cured by it. And we definitely saw that here. All those examples that we just described was basically this defamation suit served as a platform, a launch pad for a wide variety of secondary disinformation. And, you know, we've known for a long time in defamation law that this was the case, that something that we've, we call the Streisand effect. It comes from a case involving Barbara Streisand, where there were some photos she really didn't want circulated, and she sued about the circulation of them. And then, of course, they got much, much more attention than the individual first audience might have given. And the same is, of course, true here. As you described, right, the whole country inescapably exposed to these sets of lies or falsehoods that were at issue in this defamation case. And so the idea that we emerge from this with more truth is sort of laughable. It's just not a tool that is advancing that goal in any meaningful way.
I think that tension that you're talking about between, you know, defamation requiring individual harm, but many of our concerns in this area really being about societal harm or broader harms, is a really helpful example of one of my own personal bugbears, which is sort of this weakness of the individual rights frame in thinking about content moderation harms more generally. You know, the idea that if we just gave users more appeals, more reasoning, more capacity to flag things, that it would solve so many of the harms that we see appearing on social media, because it's often not actually an individual that's harmed by many of these things. Like, you know, like disinformation more generally might be one example, or is it one example. Things like, you know, terrorist recruitment is another example, where the people that are seeing it are maybe not the kinds of people that are going to be flagging it, or things like violent content as well. So I think it's just a really helpful example of something that plays into that dynamic.
But right, I agree. And I also think, right, sort of our inability to think about this as a wider problem with our sort of architecture of communication, rather than sort of laying it all on the shoulders of individual speakers and communicators and amplifiers, is a really, it's, you know, like bringing a knife to a gunfight, right? Or bringing a defamation suit to a disinformation fight. It strikes me as, it's not to say that it might not be a tool towards tackling lies that pollute our public discourse, but the idea that all of this sort of fails to recognize that our public square is infected, right, by these kind of coordinated campaigns to spew falsehood, and that they are motivated by, you know, opportunism and politics and profit. And when I hear people saying, you know, well, all we need to do is train people up to spot misinformation, right? That again just puts people, puts the onus on, right, sort of random individual old lady on Facebook, right, that she's going to solve our disinformation problem. And sort of failure to recognize that what's happening here is bigger and more complicated than that. Like, I would love, I would absolutely love if it were the case that, I mean, I'm a defamation law scholar. I would love it if defamation law was the sort of, you know, hero that would swoop into this space and solve all of the, would that it were true, right, that we could do this. But I think that we have to sort of take in the lay of the land and acknowledge that the problems are both bigger and more complicated, and also that the tools can't rise and fall on a series of individual exercises of combat.
Although I do love the idea of sending out the bat signal for the defamation law scholars. Would be a wonderful way of solving this.
Yeah. Our moment has finally arrived.
You've been waiting, sitting at the ready to tear off your shirt and reveal the superhero costume. I'm sorry, you're going to have to wait just a little longer. Although, maybe we can talk about some of the counterexamples, because I think there maybe have been a few that might make people, you know, be more hopeful about this. Things like the lawsuit that Dominion Voting Systems brought against Fox News after the cable channel reported that its voting machines worked incorrectly during the 2020 election, or perhaps Alex Jones and his Sandy Hook trutherism. You know, Jones, for example, was found liable in both Texas and Connecticut state courts for his lies about the Sandy Hook shooting, and will have to pay damages. So, you know, these maybe might give people hope. And I'm wondering whether, you know, but on the other hand, they do make people nervous because of many of the things that you've been talking about, you know, the importance of robust defamation laws. On the other hand, of course, these are really abhorrent and damaging lies. So do you think there is a way to, you know, have the good and not the bad? Is there a way to craft legal rules here to be able to use defamation for good without too much risk of abuse? Or is it just not going to be worth the candle?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that we have some emerging examples that suggest to us that in those instances in which the stars align, right, and something that is at the nub of a wider disinformation narrative also got delivered into the public sphere in a way that was targeted enough that it was an attack on an individual reputation, right, that it can serve itself up in this particular format, can be a mechanism that really at least acts to at least partially dislodge those disinformation narratives. The Smartmatic and Dominion cases that were brought against not just Fox News, but also Newsmax and Giuliani and others in former President Trump's sort of inner circle, they were the only thing really that we saw move the needle in terms of some of the coverage on some of those networks, right? Those networks were consistently presenting people in their programming who were advancing lies about the 2020 election. And it was really only the filing of that suit that reined in some of that. We saw in a fairly immediate aftermath of the filing of those defamation lawsuits, statements being read on air on the smaller of those networks. We saw Lou Dobbs lost his show, essentially, right? He was had some of the highest viewership of any program on Fox News and was canceled by the network. We saw network representatives sort of pushing back on air in ways that they hadn't previously. So, right, suggesting that there's some kind of tool here that might have an effect. And I do think that defamation law, Protect Democracy is sort of working on a series of what they think of as pro-democracy defamation actions involving, you know, various election officials who faced some pretty specific attacks on their reputation in relationship to the so-called big lie. Even in those cases, I've got to say, and in the Sandy Hook case in particular that you describe, I continue to question, right, whether the truth can overtake the lies in the mind of the sort of staunchest of the partisans that are involved in some of those situations. But I'll also point out, and I think it's really important, that all of those cases are cases that will be litigated under the New York Times versus Sullivan standard and may well win under that standard, right? It suggests that the Sullivan balance might well work for us, right? Might well strike that right kind of balance between protection of public discourse and dialogue on matters of public concern while still snuffing out and penalizing knowing falsity. So like to the extent that the concern here is active defamatory disinformation campaigns, right? Sort of wholly invented, consciously distributed conspiracy theories and lies that do real harm to individual or entity reputations. This material already falls outside the scope of the Sullivan protection. That material is by definition distributed with knowing falsity or reckless disregard for the truth. And so Sullivan doctrine, as it now stands, envisions liability for these communications. And I think the occasional, I'm an ardent free speech activist, right? I believe fervently that democracy needs the kinds of protection that Sullivan offers. But I also think that the occasional win under the Sullivan standard demonstrates its efficacy. And so we might be seeing the arc of that in some of the examples that you've described.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I think that gets to, you know, something I've been thinking about these cases, which is that, you know, in the election litigation, for example, the Alex Jones litigation, the cases are just so extreme. I mean, the Dominion and Smartmatic lawsuits, for example, like you said, there's this sort of period right around the election when Dominion and Smartmatic threatened to sue, some of the networks back off. I think I remember reading in one of the filings, and I think filed by Dominion, the complaint that, you know, Rudy Giuliani kind of backs off and stops making, you know, directly falsifiable claims about Dominion's supposed culpability in alleged election fraud. And then, you know, 2 days later, he's right back at it again. And it really just underlines, you know, how unusual and extreme, I think, the sort of quality of bad information is right now in this space, perhaps, that these suits are in a place where they can be successful to begin with. Is that fair, do you think?
No, I mean, I think that's right. But part of what's interesting about this most recent arc of cases that fall within that space is that they're surprising to defamation scholars, both as to their legal contours, but also as to their facts, right? They're just, they're hypotheticals that we really could not, I mean, if you had handed me the complaint, the Smartmatic and Dominion complaints that exist right now, and had said to me, right, teach this to your students, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, teach this as a hypothetical of a network that's accused of the kinds of things that that these networks are being accused of sort of knowing that these things are not true and moving forward in ways that amplify or encourage this kind of dialogue in order to win back view. That's the allegation, right? The allegation in the complaint is that Fox and other networks sort of knew that this was false and made a decision to advance this narrative in order to win back pro-Trump viewers. That kind of fact pattern isn't one that we really, that I would have cooked up as a hypothetical for my media law students in the past. And so thinking about what disinformation looks like and how it maps onto defamation fact patterns, I think it is a commentary about the boundaries of defamation law, but it's also a much bigger commentary about the way that disinformation is incentivized and rewarded and amplified in our sort of current modern media landscape.
And so if we think about, you know, how defamation lawsuits can be used to potentially be effective against disinformation in this sort of very, very specific limited handful of cases, How do we judge whether that would be effective? Like what's standard? I mean, because I can imagine, you know, you could say there's a deterrent effect that we'd see fewer falsehoods floating around in the future because would-be liars would be scared off, or, you know, InfoWars, for example, Alex Jones's outlet doesn't have money anymore, so it can't put out falsehoods like that. You could say that there's a benefit in having, you know, entities like Newsmax and OANN having to put out these statements, essentially walking back lies about Dominion and Smartmatic. You could say there's maybe a sort of corrective effect in having a court say, you know, actually the thing that Alex Jones is saying didn't happen really did happen. And here's a, you know, a judge putting that into the record. Do you have a sense of, you know, how we should think about what success would look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think as a starting matter, the deterrent effect that you just described is very much a double-edged sword, right? It's exactly, I mean, like sort of rephrased, it's the concern that the unanimous Sullivan Court had, right? That the sort of staggering costs to the operation of both the press function, but also the sort of the general flow of public discourse, if we have this chilling effect where people are too strongly deterred against, this is the concern that Amber Heard and her allies are raising right now, right? Why would anyone come forward and engage in public discourse on this very important matter of public concern if this sort of Damocles hangs above them as the possibility that it will fall at any moment and they might find themselves subjected to staggering damages for defamation? So the deterrent effect, like we want it so badly for people who are would-be disseminators of large-scale conspiracy theories and lies, but we also have to craft a doctrine we can't have deterrent effect be pulling the laboring oar in such a significant way that we shut down that kind of dialogue. The corrective effect, I think, is the really interesting question, right? Whether we're having the corrective effect or not. Like, I'll just give away a little piece of the story here. My co-author Larissa Litsky and I crafted a big piece of the piece that we published in Slate well before the verdict was handed down. And one of the things that we discovered was that it didn't matter how that what we had to say about it was going to be the same regardless of what the jury's verdict was in that case, because what the nation thought about this situation was already baked. People already had decided that Johnny Depp was a hero and that Amber Heard was a villain. They had already decided, they had already made their determination on the basis of the memes and the new TikTok accounts and the sort of constant serving up of that information on YouTube and elsewhere. And so questioning how effective defamation law is as an anti-disinformation tool also requires us to ask hard questions about whether it can serve that corrective, have that corrective property. And in at least some instances where the power of the social media disinformation on the other end of it is so significant, I think there are good reasons to believe that a judge announcing that something is the case, right? A judge announcing that Sandy Hook was not a set of parents who were actors is not going to dislodge from that population the viewpoint that they were. And it's just a limitation of the tool and a limitation of the current media ecosystem that we have to face squarely and try to deal with.
Yeah, I have another maybe natural experiment that I can speak to, which is Australian defamation law, which is like universally pretty terrible and acknowledged to be pretty terrible, and I apologize and I'm embarrassed about it, but at least maybe if we can squeeze some benefit out of it, it's that it's an interesting case study in what might happen if you have terrible defamation law. And we have both sides of that double-edged sword that you were talking about. Like, on the one hand, there was a case, I think it was last year, where an Australian politician got an $875,000 payout against a QAnon poster for defamation about like pedophilia charges and things like that, which were blatantly false. That person was overseas, out of jurisdiction, never had to pay. But on the other hand, do we really expect there to be chilling effects on, the broader QAnon spreading community such that they were paying attention to this or believed otherwise as a result of the judgment? I doubt it. And on the other hand, we basically had no real Me Too movement in Australia because there were a number of very high profile cases in which men got defamation judgments against outlets and accusers. So I think that sort of really speaks to the tension that you're talking about, or the double-edged sword that you were just sort of talking about. And so then against that sort of bleak background, let's go back to New York Times v. Sullivan and this pillar of First Amendment law, which we were saying there are some indications that some signs for it to be some sort of rumblings about it and some instability. So can you talk about that? What indications have there been, and where does it look like it's heading potentially?
Yes, well, in some respects, the conversation about this was launched by Donald Trump, who, as a then candidate in the run-up to the 2016 election, spoke sort of quite famously about wanting to, quote, open up libel law, by which I think he means the opposite. He meant tighten up or make available libel law. And essentially saying he as a public figure and now public official, did not care for the Sullivan standard and the fact that it made it difficult for him to threaten or bring libel suits against his critics. Or against those that he wanted to say were lying about him. And in truth, the legal world sort of laughed at him, right? And said, well, Sullivan, right? We're not going to open up libel law. Sullivan is rock solid and it is longstanding precedent. And it's rooted in some core First Amendment values, both rooted in First Amendment values about our commitment to dialogue in the public sphere, but also rooted in some core values of democracy, right? About how we keep an eye on and have a watchdog function on those who are in positions of leadership over us to make sure that they can't wield defamation law as a sort of hammer to crack down on, to threaten lawsuits against their critics and shut down dissent. But it wasn't very many years later from this that we got the first justice on the Supreme Court suggesting that he was willing to do just that. This was Justice Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas, in a case that was actually involving Me Too litigation, or an outgrowth of a Me Too litigation, a case called Cosby versus McKee. It involved a person who was a victim of Bill Cosby, and a sort of public figure defamation suit. And in it, the court declined to take the case, but Justice Thomas wrote separately to say that he thought that they should have taken the case or should take, he actually concurred. He agreed that this wasn't a good vehicle, but that we should keep our eyes peeled for another such case, and we should take it, and we should overturn Sullivan. Now, Thomas's viewpoint on this is actually a somewhat idiosyncratic view. He roots his view on Sullivan in a question of originalism, and his view is that libel was not constitutionalized at the time of the founders. The founders would have thought that the First Amendment didn't stand as a barrier to bringing defamation actions, and because of that, he would move us back to that framework and see Sullivan as sort of an act of judicial activism that was inappropriate. We should leave it to the states to decide what kinds of standards they want to have in their common law and move forward on it. It was last year that Justice Neil Gorsuch joined Justice Thomas in another similar case involving a public figure who was seeking a writ of certiorari, a grant of a writ of certiorari at the Supreme Court in a defamation action. And Justice Gorsuch chimed in to say some sort of passing support for that originalism notion from Justice Thomas, but more squarely rooting his concern in the kinds of things that we've been talking about. This concern about widespread disinformation and the changing media landscape and the sort of proliferation of dangerous lies in our public discourse, and that unwinding Sullivan might be a tool for doing that. So we now have two justices who have chimed in to say that they would take a case and that they would be willing to reconsider some aspect. We don't know how much of, we know for Justice Thomas, all of it. We don't know for Justice Gorsuch how much of it, but would reconsider Sullivan and its progeny in some ways. There is another case that has been sitting on the Supreme Court's conference list for a really long time that folks watch really closely that may well either be granted or probably is producing additional folks who are writing separately in dissents from denial of certiorari, maybe just Gorsuch and Thomas again, but maybe they've got other folks who are willing to join in. And so there is some sense that something that was thought of as largely inconceivable 4 or 5 years ago is now something that at least some justices of the Supreme Court are entertaining and some are quite eager to do.
So I think this is inextricably tied up with members of the court, the justices' view of the media. So tell us about the study that you did with your co-author, Sonia West, about how the Supreme Court is viewing the media over time. What did you study and what did you find?
Yeah, we coded every paragraph that referenced the press in or the press function in any way over the entire course of the Supreme Court's history, looking to see both the frequency and the tone that the justices of the court use when they speak of the press, and found a quite stark decline in the justices' sort of positivity about the press. That is, for a very, very long time, post-incorporation of the First Amendment in particular, they spoke with some frequency about not just the press, but the freedom of the press, casting the press as positive, as worthy of protection, even when it wasn't behaving well, of sort of central to our democracy, as core to shaping our public conversations and engaging in that watchdog behavior. And the characterizations of the press now are either not happening at all, they're sort of just not making reference to the press, or when they are happening, increasingly have taken on a negative tone. We have to connect the dots a little to think about what that means in terms of outcome, but in terms of sort of doctrinal shifts, but in terms of the sort of baseline well of goodwill and rhetoric about the positive value and role of the press function of news gathering and distribution of information on matters of public concern in society, we have moved. We have seen a notable shift, and in particular during the Roberts Court era, a sort of stark downturn in perceptions of the press from justices at the Supreme Court, which probably doesn't bode well in terms of outcomes in these sorts of areas. Sullivan is not, it's important for us to note, a press-specific outcome. That is, it doesn't say the media has a right to criticize or to engage, gets that kind of breathing space on falsehoods in order to encourage it to have commentary on matters of public concern. All of us have it. But it for sure came about in this through this vehicle where the underlying set of concerns were that the press is a good thing, that it's doing good work for us, that it's central, the press function is central to our democracy. And absent that, a lot of these cases may well turn out differently.
And so what do you think is driving this? Is it a question of politics and that it's conservative justices who are losing faith in the press? Is it because, you know, we need more journalists on the Supreme Court? Like, what is the factor here that's moving it forward?
So it's really hard to determine. We did parse out, sort of mapped our data onto Supreme Court database data and data that clocked the justices' Martin Quinn scores, the sort of ideology data that helped us to track the influence that ideology plays in all of this. And it turns out that although there is some connection, the more conservative a justice is, the more likely they are to speak negatively about the press. And in the whole of our historical data, it is the case that there's some soft correlation between conservatism and press negativity and liberalism and press positivity. That link is not very strong at all today. The Roberts Court justices, in fact, when we sort of narrow in and look at the justices, the liberal justices who were on the court at the time that our study concluded, were not particularly press positive. In fact, there hadn't been a single positive reference to the trustworthiness of the press from any justice of any ideological background for more than a decade. We sort of clock in our heads that press positivity might be sort of advanced by liberal justices. And in part, the reason that we do that is because some of the major cases that we're talking, you know, we get Sullivan at the hands of, the sort of Brennan and Black and Douglas, we think of as both liberal lions and also particularly press positive justices in the arc of history. And both of those things are true, but it isn't the case that we can sort of so easily explain these phenomena. The phenomena are not fully explainable through ideology. It may well be that the changing media landscape is affecting folks across the board, although our study, we worked carefully to capture not just references to the legacy media, but also to what we sort of called in our code book, the press function, right? So towards the tail end of the data set, we're including, for example, so-called citizen journalists, right? People who are engaging in news gathering by taking cell phone footage of something that's happening that's a matter of public concern. And even then, when we take into account that kind of behavior, there just isn't as much rhetorical positivity that surrounds that kind of dialogue, that kind of function in ways that do concern us.
So without speculating, you know, what's motivating the particular justices at all, I think, you know, it is fair to say that this changing modern ecosystem is creating anxiety that is, you know, more broadly causing people to question, you know, whether law is well suited. And, you know, I do have some sympathy for the idea that our modern ecosystem, information ecosystem, is very different. I mean, it's just indisputable that the internet has changed things, that, you know, content travels further and faster than ever before. You can suffer international damage to your reputation in minutes. You know, all of this played out in the Amber Heard trial, where we were talking about all of the harmful content and misogynistic content that was targeted at her and how prominent it was. And so I guess the question is, how legally salient are those factual changes? And I'm curious for your thoughts about whether, you know, this quite dramatically changed information ecosystem, whether you feel as a defamation law scholar that anything about the law needs updating, or whether those sort of fundamental principles, those first principles, still hold true.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good question. And I think part of the disconnect that we see here is that Justice Gorsuch, his starting proposition seems absolutely, unquestionably correct. That is, that the advent of the internet and the arrival of social media and the radical shift, the sort of decentralization of our media landscape has changed things. And he says, right, shifted in ways that few could have foreseen, and that that has to be right. And he's also right that some piece of that means that disinformation and misinformation flourish in ways that they didn't before. I mean, one of the pieces that I think is tricky here in thinking about the law as a tool, and particularly defamation law as a tool, is that if you burrow down and sort of look at Justice Gorsuch's main sets of concerns, they're all sort of the kind of concern that you were describing, which is sort of amplification concerns, right? They're concerns, he says in his opinion from last year, right, that the new media environment facilitates the spread of disinformation, right? Or he's worried about falsehoods in quantities that no one could have envisioned 60 years ago. Those are all about the speed, right, of virality of spread, but also the quantity of spread. They're amplification questions, right? And amplification questions don't map really well onto questions about a set of doctrines that focus on liability for defamation, like reputational harm. And so I do think that our questions about how law and policy have to shift to confront and deal with and focus on the changing media landscape are valid ones. I just think that they are sort of, as I said earlier, and as sort of you suggested, right, individual liability doctrines might not be the mechanism by which law serves us or best serves us or primarily serves us in this realm. And instead, wider conversations about the interrelationship between the law and the architecture of our public square, and the interrelationship between law and the behaviors of private platforms, and the sort of combination of those regulatory incentives and legal rules and societal norms, I think are all at play there. But none of those sort of core amplification concerns are perfectly matched to a sort of reputational harm legal doctrine. And that's the place that I think it's easy to get sort of sucked into the starting premise of the notion that, right, oh, okay, Sullivan exists and it makes it difficult to sue for defamation, and defamation is about lies. And so if we unwind it, we'll have less defamation or more consequences for defamation and fewer lies. And I think our lie problem and our amplification of lie problem is so much different in scale and in scope. And our concerns are so amplification focused that thinking more creatively about the role that law plays in the amplification space might be a better tree to bark up.
Let's leave it there. Renaud, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Arbiters of Truth, the Lawfare podcast series on our online information ecosystem. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare podcast feed and in our separate Arbiters of Truth podcast feed, and we'll be back with another episode next Thursday. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare Materials supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. Where you'll get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.